This is Bristol Bay and Beyond, KDLG's weekly news magazine. It's Friday, August 7th. I'm your host, Dave Benninger. Thanks for joining us. Coming up this week, we'll continue our hunting season series of conversations with wildlife managers, today with a focus on the Area 17 moose.
We've had two easy winters in a row, and that usually spells pretty good survival of calves. And, you know, the moose can do pretty well. They stay spread out. They have a lot of forage that they can get to. I would think the moose are doing pretty good. And hopefully there's a lot of young bulls out there.
The city of Manicotic is moving ahead with its efforts to annex the Agushik fishing section.
Instead of paying raw fish tax to Dillon, pay a raw fish tax to the city of Manicotic.
We'll join a hunt for dinosaur fossils in Katmai, follow a new teacher around on her first day in Dillingham, and Dr. Kathy Heineman discusses the danger behind the use of an over-the-counter medicine some are using to treat heroin withdrawals.
The overuse of Imodium can cause fatal heart rhythms and probably accounts for more death than maybe we're aware of.
Those stories are coming up after a look back at some of the week's news. Yesterday, the city of Manicotic held a meeting to take public comment on their petition to annex the Agushik section of the Nooshigak Commercial Fishing District. The annexation would allow the city to levy a 2% raw fish tax and was favored by most of those in attendance, including Anisha Alakiak Lomak.
Our ancestors, our parents, our grandparents were culturally, seemed like, raised there, and we were raised there in lifestyle. We lose our lifestyle if we don't get this annexation, so I'm supporting it 100%.
The city is taking public comment on the petition through August 14th. This week, the Bristol Bay Native Corporation announced it had finalized the purchase of Bristol Alliance Fuels in Dillingham, including the Bristol Express gas station downtown. President and CEO Jason Matrokin says it's part of the regional Native Corporation's intent to reinvest in Bristol Bay.
About 4.5 years ago, the BBNC board made a commitment to invest back in the Bristol Bay region. And early on in that process, BBNC acquired the Mission Lodge at Aleknagik. And just on Friday last week, BBNC acquired Bristol Alliance Fuels and Bristol Express, the convenience store and tank farm in Dillingham.
Terms of the sale were not disclosed. Further north, the Bering Straits Native Corporation announced this week it had purchased Alaska Industrial Hardware, one of the leading construction and industrial equipment sales companies in the state. There was some good news for the sockeye market Tuesday when the U.S. Department of Agriculture announced it would purchase up to $30 million of canned sockeye salmon to put in food banks around the country. Senator Lisa Murkowski asked Agricultural Secretary Tom Vilsack to approve the purchase, citing the glut of canned reds that was driving down the price and hurting Alaska's fishing industry. Sockeye fishing in the Togiak District continues but appears to be winding down. As the counting tower came down Thursday, the final escapement count in the river was 213,000. That's according to Fish and Game's Matt Jones.
Where we've ended up now is one of the highest escapements we've had since I've been the area manager.
The total harvest is past 300,000, but still shy of the preseason forecast for the district of a little more than 400,000 sockeye. Aqua Bounty Technologies, the biotech company that intends to market a genetically modified salmon it created, posted a net loss for the first half of the year of $3.5 million. The company says it's spending heavily on tests and marketing for field trials in foreign markets. Aqua Bounty believes it will receive FDA approval for its product, which some deridingly call Frankenfish, sometime later this year. The total run tally has not been added up yet, but the Nooshigak River Kings came in stronger than expected this year, surpassing the management goal of 95,000 in river. So says area sportfish biologist Jason Dye.
That was kind of a pleasant surprise to me. I was a little bit, you know, cautious about what I thought was going to happen this year. So we ended up with 98,019 past the sonar, and that, of course, exceeds the management plan goal of 95,000.
Dye says the run peaked around the end of June. The commercial catch was 40 to 50,000 kings, and Fish and Game is still waiting on a count of sport and subsistence catch. The city of Dillingham is moving forward with another round of foreclosures, citing $43,000 owed on some 40 properties inside city limits. City Manager Rose Louetta says most of the owners owe between a couple hundred and a couple thousand dollars.
These are people that are in default, and we've tried to collect up to this point, but have not succeeded. So we're following our process and now recommending they go through a foreclosure process.
Last month, the city announced it had finalized its foreclosure on all of the properties owned by Jim Bingman Sr. This week, police arrested his son, Jim Jr., on a charge he was trespassing at one of the buildings he had since been evicted from. Bingman said he was just working on retrieving family belongings. Also on our crime and safety beat, a new Stuyahok man was medevaced to Anchorage for injuries sustained during an alleged assault this week. 27-year-old Nick Nikita was arrested for the assault, which sent his brother-in-law, Stephen Petla, to the hospital for surgery. Troopers say both men had been drinking. And state troopers are investigating the death of a man from Emonic in the village of Twin Hills. 30-year-old Charlie Killingock Jr. was found dead in the employee housing unit of Togiak Fisheries Wednesday night. The cause of his death is unknown, and his body has been sent for an autopsy. More on this week's news can be found at our website, kdlg.org. You're listening to Bristol Bay and Beyond on KDLG. Yesterday, the city of Manicotic held a public meeting to discuss its proposed annexation, this of the Agushik section of the Nooshigak Commercial Fishing District. Manicotic has said it's moving forward with its own annexation, which it feels is a logical objection to paying 2.5% raw fish tax to Dillingham, that is if Dillingham's annexation goes back into effect. Agushik Beach is fished primarily by set netters from Manicotic, though the entire section is fished by any number of drifters in the Nooshigak. Mayor Melvin Andrews spoke with me this morning for an update on the meeting yesterday about the city's efforts. Mayor Andrew, good as always to speak with you. What was your take from last night's public meeting on this proposed annexation?
My take was that it was positive and supportive for the draft annexation petition City of Manicotic will submit to LBC here shortly.
What are some of your residents, citizens, neighbors, what did they like about the idea, and also what concerns did you hear? I heard at least one person say they weren't wild about the added tax, whether it went to Manicotic or Dillingham.
Yes, that is one of the concerns of some of the residents here in Manicotic, but most of the commercial fishermen who have a set net site in Agushik support the idea. Instead of paying a raw fish tax to Dillingham, pay a raw fish tax to the city of Manicotic. But all in all, I believe all the residents are in support of that annexation petition.
There were some folks in Dillingham wondered if that meeting wasn't scheduled in conflict with Dillingham City Council meeting on purpose. Was that the case?
No, we did not know about the City of Dillingham's meeting. The reason we scheduled it for August 6th was we were supposed to schedule it in July, but it might conflict with the commercial fishing season. So we set it to the first week or the first part of August, so there'll be time for the fishermen and sit netters to come in.
All right. Mayor, as Dillingham has learned, it's kind of a lengthy process dealing with annexation and the LBC and all the rest. What do you see in the near future, and what's your time frame for this proposal here in your mind?
The time frame that was set is for approximately a year or a little over a year until we get the final outcome. And we've learned from Dillingham following their process, it's going to take a while, and we're ready for it.
Do you think this will make Manicotic and Dillingham better neighbors, or add a little bit of tension to the mix here?
You know, I'm talking with Mayor Alice Ruby previously in reference to their annexation. We sat down and we decided to work together, even though this may come up. There's a time that we will not agree to everything. We may differ, but we have, in general, agreed to start working together.
Mayor Melvin Andrew in Manicotic speaking with us today after last night's public hearing on the proposed annexation for a 2% fish tax from the Agushik section. Mayor Andrew, it's good to speak with you as always. Thanks so much, sir.
Thank you. Good morning.
Well, we are into the fall hunting season in southwest Alaska's caribou hunting opened at the beginning of the month. Next on the big game list is moose, which opens soon for most of Bristol Bay's west side hunters. Fish and Game wildlife biologist for the GMU 17's Neil Barton joined me this week to continue our series of conversations with wildlife managers. Neil, it's good to have you back in the studio.
Thank you.
Within 2 weeks, just about everybody on the west side of Bristol Bay should be open, all the residential hunts for the A, B, and C. B and C first, and A follows along behind. How's our herd looking?
Well, hopefully well. We did not get a moose survey this year. You know, as everybody knows, we were all sitting around in February, March, and April without snow, so nobody could snow machine, and we couldn't do a moose count. But, you know, we've had two easy winters in a row, and that usually spells pretty good survival of calves. And, you know, the moose can do pretty well. They stay spread out. They have a lot of forage that they can get to that in a snowy winter they can't because they get pushed down to the river bottom. So I would think the moose are doing pretty good. And hopefully there's a lot of young bulls out there from high calf survival. So,
when was the last time a moose survey was done, and what did the numbers look like in your mind?
We did get a moose survey in 17C in the spring of 14, and the numbers we got compared very favorably with the previous survey 3 years prior to that. And we had just a few more moose estimated in the population back then. So we try to get these areas, 17C and 17B, we try to get the different sections of them surveyed every 3 to 4 years, maybe. That's about all we can, you know, really realistically do. So, you know, hopefully we'll get one this winter in the western portion of 17B.
It seems like there's the possibility we're going to have another warm fall. What does that do to moose behavior, specifically with our bulls?
Well, I mean, you know, there's a lot of, you know, talk out there that, you know, the moose rut is so dependent on weather, you know, the frost factor, that kind of thing. I think it's been shown to be more dependent on daylight. And so, you know, if we get into the middle of September again, I would expect the bull moose are going to be rutting, you know, kind of on cue based on daylight more so than if we have a warmer fall. But certainly that affects them to some degree just because they're more active if it's cooler out.
Would you do any calling or scratching early season if it's 70 degrees out every day?
Well, you know, I talk to a lot of moose hunters, and I have some that are just diehard callers, and they're committed to it. And that's just not here. It's different places I've worked in Yakutat, down toward Juneau, Haines, all over the place. And people who are committed to calling, who really work at it, it's kind of an art, they're very effective at it. And you know, there's only so much brush busting you can do. You can hop up on a riverbank. In a lot of cases, you can't see very far, so you can't necessarily go to the moose. But if you can bring the moose to you, it makes a big difference.
I've had a conversation with you before, and we've talked about that idea of that some hunters want a little bit more time in the rut. You've worked in other parts of the state, both as Fish and Game and also as a guide. You say we've got a tastier moose product to harvest early.
You know, a lot of people think, you know, as a moose get into the rut, the bull moose in particular, obviously, but they, you know, with the hormonal flow, that kind of thing, and they're rolling in their own wallows, that kind of thing, the meat doesn't taste as well, and the chance of contamination of meat when you're butchering is a lot higher. And, you know, with our season stopping at the end of the 15th here, can accommodates the early part of the rut, but not into the middle of the rut, where a number of people think the meat isn't as tasty, so, and that's a good thing.
How often do you talk to hunters who say the only bull they saw of the season was on the 16th of September?
Well, if you look at the harvest records, the last, you know, the 12th to the 15th is a pretty good time. You know, I think the moose do get more active, and because they're more active, they're more vulnerable to be seen, more vulnerable to be called, and it makes for a better opportunity to get a moose. So, you know, if you're out those last 3 or 4 days and the weather cooperates, I think because moose are more active, you have a better chance of getting one.
Why is it that storm always likes to blow out right about the 12th and 13th of the month?
Exactly, yeah.
What was our success rate over the last couple of years in broad terms?
Well, I mean, last year we took a few more moose than the previous year. Unit 17A, I think we took 57 moose there last year, the highest we've ever taken, and that's carrying a lot of the increase in the harvest last year.
Was that through the winter?
That included the winter hunt, yep. And, you know, the moose population out there, it's a younger population as far as they haven't been there as long. They're very productive. And, you know, it's a population that's just still increasing, and it's kind of in what we call an eruptive stage. when you get in 17B and C, moose have been here a lot longer. They've, you know, pretty much saturated the different habitats that they can use, and they're not as productive as the moose out west. So, you know, the harvest in 17B and C over the last 10 years has been on a downward trend, and you know, it's just factors of some hard winters in the last 10 years and habitats that maybe aren't as good as they used to be. And you know, predators figure the system out, that kind of thing. And so the populations are still healthy, I think, but the harvest has certainly declined on a somewhat gradual and steady slope in the last 10 years.
You wouldn't say that's from either lack of or dwindling effort or for over harvest back in the heyday?
Well, you know, you can only shoot bull moose, and so we don't have cow hunts here in 17B and C. As far as the over harvest, I mean, the bull harvest is going down, and one of the questions we have, because as managers we need to know this, is what is the bull cow ratio? I mean, we want to have 25 to 30 bulls per 100 cows. We just don't know what we got out there. And that's, you know, one of the things that we're trying to work on. And even without snow on the ground this coming spring or winter and next spring, is to try to get at the bull to cow ratio, because we really need that information. And, you know, they're, when you're getting fewer and fewer bulls every year, is it because they're not on the landscape, or are their hunting patterns changing, or is the habitat changing to where the moose that are available are a little further off the river systems? We're not sure about that, but we're going to be looking into the bull cow ratio, which is really the most pertinent bit of information we could get for that. So
let me ask for the fish and game perspective. What's on your mind?
You know, we do have the registration permits and the harvest ticket as well for people who hunt under the general season harvest ticket. But with all these hunts, caribou and moose in particular here, we need people to report. We need them to report as accurately as they can and provide us the information we need, which isn't just, I hunted, but I was on the Stewyhawk River, or I was here or there, hunted for 7 to 10 days or whatever it might be, and what's your mode of, if you use an aircraft or a boat, whatever transportation you use, because we do take all that information and put it into a database. And just last year at the Board of Game, a lot of that information was very handy and very important to present to the board for Board of Game decisions. So we really need that. And moose, people are doing pretty darn good. The caribou, not so much, but the moose, people are doing really good with reporting, and I hope that keeps up.
Neil Barton, it's good to speak with you as always. Thanks for coming in the studio.
Yeah, it's been very fun, and thanks for inviting me.
Earlier this summer, Ray Troll was invited to be an artist in residence at Katmai National Park and Preserve. While there, Troll went in search of animals millions of years older than the park's iconic brown bears. KDLG's Hannah Colton tells this tale of the search for dinosaurs in the Valley of 10,000 Smokes.
Ketchikan artist Ray Troll may be most widely known for his art and music celebrating all things fish. Perhaps fewer know about his love for prehistoric creatures.
I'm a paleo nerd from day one. I'm an artist, but I'm a lifelong paleo nerd, you know, and I sing songs about trilobites and draw pictures of tyrannosaurs and all that kind of stuff.
While in Katmai, Troll mentioned this interest to the park's chief of interpretation, Roy Wood, who's a bit of a fossil fanatic himself.
And so he asked if it would be possible to go poke around in some of the fossil layers in Katmai National Park. So we went out to the Valley of 10,000 Smokes, where we have a rock formation called the Naknek Formation.
Wood says this rock layer, the Naknek Formation, has turned up all sorts of fossils over the years.
Mostly marine-type fossils, things related to modern-day clams and nautiloids and belemnites and things like that, but also dinosaur tracks.
Now, Wood is no stranger to the Valley of 10,000 Smokes. Each year, he spends some time out there looking for traces of dinosaurs.
So it was great to be out there with someone else who was very interested in this, with this lifelong, you know, 10-year-old boy dream of finding dinosaurs. And we're crawling around, we're looking under every rock layer, and there's some places that started to look a little interesting.
They started to see signs of ancient life. First, a spiraled piece of ammonite, then some fossil plants.
These terrestrial plant fossils right there sort of indicate that it's going to be a marshy area, a tidal area, like a lagoon or something. And that's typically where at least this type of dinosaur would have lived.
There's sandstone right above this.
That's Troll again.
And that's the kind of stuff you might find prints in. And it seemed like the smoking gun was going to be if we found a three-toed something.
As they walked down the trail, Troll spotted an area of sandstone with all these pock marks.
It sort of looked like a big dance floor in my mind's eye.
And so at the right angle, you could see what appears to us to be dinosaur tracks. Some of them are very indistinct, but others have three toes, just like you would expect a hadrosaur to have, one of the duck-billed dinosaurs.
They took a bunch of photos and returned to King Salmon with high hopes. If these truly are dinosaur tracks, Wood says they would be the first found within the boundaries of Katmai National Park.
The 10-year-old in me wants it to be dinosaur tracks so much, but the adult says, I don't get too excited, Junior. And that's where I kind of am right now, that I really want it to be that, but that doesn't mean it is.
So this is where we get the experts in. I'm a kind of, an expert to a certain degree, but I'm not a, paleontologist. I just play one on TV or on guitar, But I'm 99-ish% sure these are prints, and I hope I'm not mortally embarrassed by this, but I think that I really do think they are.
When Ray sent me the picture, I knew right away he'd made a mistake. He made a fatal mistake.
That's Kirk Johnson, director of the Smithsonian National Museum of Natural History in D.C., and a paleontologist who's discovered thousands of dinosaur tracks. Johnson and Troll are old friends and co-authored a book in which they road-tripped across mid-America in search of fossils. Johnson says in this case, Troll had all the right evidence. He was looking at the right rocks. The fatal mistake was that he was looking at them upside down.
And the way that tracks actually get preserved is if an animal walks on a muddy layer and the mud hardens and then is buried later by a layer of sand. So that usually in sandstone, tracks are made as depressions that face downward into an underlying layer of mudstone rock.
The way to find real dinosaur prints, he says, is to look at the underside of a sandstone slab, not the top. I called up Troll again to see how he was taking the news.
My dreams being destroyed before my eyes, but Kirk's actually used to doing that with his rather ambitious artist partner. So he's broken my heart a few times over the years.
This team is not giving up on the Naknek Formation. Troll and Johnson are actually working on another book now, one that will cover the fossils of the entire West Coast. Johnson says there's still time to get Katmai into that book. For now, Troll says, this episode might just be fodder for another song by his band, the Ratfish Wranglers. In Dillingham, I'm Hannah Colton.
That's Ray Troll and the Ratfish Wranglers off the 2010 album Cruisin' the Fossil Freeway. This is Bristol Bay and Beyond, back in a moment. On this program earlier this summer, we spoke with the mother of a young man from Dillingham who had died on account of his addiction to opioid drugs. But what Eleanor Roll told us about her son George's death was not what we expected. She said that the medical report said George had died of basically a heart attack, which had likely been caused by an overdose of Imodium AD, an over-the-counter drug used to treat diarrhea. But Imodium AD is also used by some to treat withdrawal symptoms from heroin, which is what the young man's family believes was the case. Here to talk more about what she says is a dangerous practice is Kathy Heineman, a family physician at the Kanakanak Hospital in Dillingham. It's good to have you back in the studio.
A pleasure to be back here.
Are you aware of people that are self-medicating their addictions with these combinations of over-the-counter narcotics?
I have heard of people self-medicating with a variety of things to overcome some of the side effects of coming down from narcotic addiction. For instance, Imodium or Lomotil has been used, but it does come at a risk.
Well, everybody knows Imodium. How are people using it, and why is it a risk?
Under normal circumstances, Imodium is used for diarrhea. It just slows down your gut. Curiously, narcotics also slow down your gut. To be honest, I'm not sure of the exact biological link between Imodium and narcotics, but I have heard from folks who should know that taking Imodium can overcome some of the symptoms of withdrawal. I also know that the dose of Imodium that is recommended is no more than 8 milligrams a day.
That's for diarrhea.
Correct.
Okay, and folks who are treating themselves or trying to come down off withdrawals are taking hundreds of pills a day.
Quite possibly. And unfortunately, there is a significant risk with that medicine. The risk has to do with heart rhythm problems. The heart can be compared to an electrical system, like the spark plugs and spark plug wires in your car. If you are taking Imodium, it essentially puts your timing off. If you're taking Imodium to excess, it puts your timing off. And the effect is that when your heart is supposed to be relaxing in between beats, that period of time between the start of the beat and the end of the beat is called the QT interval. That interval gets longer and longer and longer and comes to the point that you can go into potentially fatal heart rhythm problems like ventricular tachycardia or ventricular fibrillation, where the heart just doesn't have a chance to stop. The treatment for that is, if you're lucky enough to be someplace where we can catch that on a monitor, we can shock your heart and possibly stop that rhythm. But if you're doing this at home and you go into an abnormal heart rhythm there, maybe it'll stop or maybe it won't. If it does stop, you're lucky. If it doesn't stop, you're dead.
Does a person necessarily need to have a pre-existing heart condition to stumble into these potentially lethal effects?
No, they don't. There are some cases of people who do have a genetically occurring long QT syndrome problem, and they really and you would never know that unless you had reason to have an EKG done. But a person can have a perfectly normal heart, take a lot of this medicine over the course of time, develop that prolonged QT interval, never feel it, because just like you don't really think about the spark plug wires sparking in your car till something breaks, you don't think about your heart rhythm. You can't feel your heart rhythm prolonging in that one piece until it's too late.
Okay. But again, this idea of self-medicating with Imodium, it seems to be to blame, at least the mother of a young man believes that's what killed him, not necessarily the narcotics, but the overdosing or the use of this Imodium. And you would say that this is not safe, this is not recommended, and you believe it's dangerous.
I believe overuse of any drug is quite likely dangerous. Clearly, overuse of Imodium can cause fatal heart rhythms and probably accounts for more death than maybe we're aware of. Curiously, methadone also causes that same QT prolongation, and it's listed as a warning sign for oxycodone and hydrocodone and morphine as well.
So in other words, all of the alternatives to heroin or other opioid drugs are dangerous in some degree in their own right.
That is correct. I mean, having diarrhea every now and again is not a big deal. Taking an Imodium every now and again is not a big deal. But you shouldn't be going through a Costco-sized bottle of Imodium every week.
Dr. Kathy Heineman, it's good as always to have you. Thanks for helping us understand a little bit better.
My pleasure.
And we'll end this week's show with a new beginning. Teachers are moving into the area ahead of the new school year. As many know, moving to a town like Dillingham can be surprising, even a little shocking in ways both good and bad. For this story, KDLG's Matt Martin spent most of Thursday with a new teacher on her very first day in town. Her name is Sarah Grace Durrence, and she'll be teaching first grade.
The first day in Dillingham for new teachers involves a lot of introductions.
Sarah, nice to meet
you.
And you are?
First grade.
First grade.
This is Sarah.
Hi, Sarah. Nice to meet you.
Laurel. Where's the newbies?
And here are you?
Sarah Grace. Nice to meet you.
You're first?
Yes, ma'am.
All right. Nice meeting you. Welcome.
Thank you.
This will be the second year of teaching first grade for Sarah Grace Durrence. She spent the last year teaching in Waco, Texas, but she says she doesn't really have a place she calls home.
I say Auburn might where I went to college.
She may not have a place to call home, but the pride in her alma mater, Auburn University, is thick. And she couldn't have been happier to see blue carpet and orange tile, Auburn's colors, in her classroom. She says that going to Auburn is more than just going to a school.
It becomes a part of your life. You know, you wear the colors, you know, you buy your car might be blue. You bleed orange and blue. Like, that's what people say.
She sees it as a sign that even without loved ones close by, she can make Dillingham her home.
Even though I'm 6,000 miles or 5,000 miles away from home, it's silly and weird, but, you know, to have orange and blue, and I'll probably put Auburn stickers or Auburn, you know, memorabilia up in this room in random places, just to have home away from home. Because, you know, I won't have anybody here that really is family. So that's kind of cool to me.
She doesn't see this as just a teaching vacation.
I'm excited to be here, and not to vacation here, but to live here. So, and it's a one-way ticket, so I don't know when I'm leaving. That's the cool part. So I'm excited.
So now that you're here, does it seem real now that you're here in your classroom?
You know, it kind of has hit me, but it kind of hasn't. I think whenever I sleep here tonight and I wake up tomorrow and I'm like, holy cow, I'm not within walking distance of a CVS or a Walmart or, you know, somewhere where I can go pick up French fries at McDonald's. Then it'll hit me.
She didn't have to wait long for the reality of life in Dillingham to hit her. A quick trip to NNN to pick up some shampoo and toothpaste did the trick.
Oh my gosh. Eight? Oh my God. That is insane. This right here would be like 70 cents. Oh my God, this is horrible.
Her soft and sweet Southern accent couldn't hide her frustration.
So what are your thoughts walking out of the grocery store?
I'm ticked. That I'm on a teacher salary, and now I understand why that lady said that it's so hard to afford it here. So that's the last time I'll probably buy it in the grocery store.
Then Durrence, along with another new teacher, jumped in a school van to go up to the lake. The scenic views and gentle waves of the lake quickly washed away the frustrations of the grocery store.
I definitely made the right decision, obviously. So, this is incredible. Within a couple of hours, I am just blown away.
The magnetic pull of the lake and Alaska wilderness had its effect on the young Southerner.
Looking at this, I'm like, holy cow. This is just the beginning of a chapter, a big giant chapter of a big giant novel that I get to write. So I'm excited. I know I've said that like 1,000 times today, but it's just so overwhelming. There are not words to describe this. I've never experienced something like this.
Even with the receipt from the most expensive bottle of shampoo she's ever bought in her life tucked into her wallet, Durrence says the pretty views at the lake and the spirit she's felt of Alaska have convinced her that she'll be staying more than just 1 year. And she'll have some great smelling hair the first day of class. In Dillingham, I'm Matt Martin.
I've been wandering through this land, doing the best I can, trying to find what I was meant to do. And the people that I see look as worried as can be, and it looks like they are wondering too. And I can't help but wonder where I'm bound, where I'm bound.
That's it for this week's Bristol Bay and Beyond, our weekly news magazine on KDLG. A tip of the hat to KDLG's longtime general manager and engineer, Rob Carpenter, who has kept this station on the airwaves in more ways than one for decades. Rob worked his official last day today, and we celebrated his retirement this afternoon. He'll still be around the area and occasionally here at the station, so if you see Rob and you happen to be a fan of KDLG's AM and FM radio, news, and online presence, mention as much to him. Rob, from all of us here, job well done, and we wish you and Gina the best going forward. See you next week.
That's over you. And I can't help but wonder where I'm bound, where I'm bound. Can't help but wonder where I'm bound.